Welcome to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes before, during and after elite sport. This is the podcast where you'll hear current and former sports people share their highs and lows in pursuit of sporting excellence, describe how they manage their relationships, financial infrastructure and personal happiness in the face of the pressure sport brings, and how they transfer the skills and personality traits that push them towards their sporting goals into everyday life and the workplace. I'm Mark Clement. This podcast is brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World, and their personal performance program. Alongside me, my co-host, Scott Ward, a retired professional footballer who spent the last 10 years working in athlete welfare. Just remind us, Scott, why you are so passionate on this subject.
Well, I think this is something that's extremely topical, Mark. There's been an awful lot of news over the last 12, 24 months, really, around general welfare within sport. Clearly, that's spoken about in different guises, be it actual welfare of children, to even those that are of an older age, shall we say, coming out of the back end of sport. And I think for an extremely long time, we've been happy to ride the wave of fanfare in sport and accept the success, especially around Olympic sports that Team GB has brought more recently. But the unspoken has always been, okay, what are the repercussions of? So for me personally, my experience is obviously fairly unique, and it was about exploring how others felt and what we could do to prevent the cliff edge trauma that many of them face, or most of them face.
We as society owe sports people far better holistic care.
I don't think society does. I think society hasn't been given a responsibility to look after us. I think that sport is now understanding that there are consequences of contributing yourself to a given sector for a very long time. I think that society do have an impact on the way that we think because of the value of opinion that is given towards that. And as an athlete, that's how you are marked. You're marked upon your performance and the levels that you can offer. So therefore, I think, as I say, we need to be extremely careful in how we phrase that. But I think that sport is aware now that we need to extend our services for athletes beyond ensuring that you get the quickest time on the track or in the water.
And we had a great response. I mean, it's early days of Blood, Sweat and Fears, but we had a great response from all sorts of different sports people, elite sports people, right across the whole set.
Yeah, it's been fantastic, I must say. For us, this is a way of allowing athletes to speak openly and honestly about their journeys. And we never really expected there to be such a breadth of response from people in business, leadership, individuals in different roles, athletes that have maybe had a very short period in the game and then are now working in the corporate industry. You know, it's been fast spread. And again, that's one of the reasons why EY as a business are committed to this area.
And talking of athletes, talking about their experiences, joining us for this episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, former professional rower who represented Great Britain at 13 World Championships and 3 Olympic Games, winning a gold in Beijing in 2008 and a silver medal at London 2012. Mark Hunter is with us. So too, Olympic silver medal winning diver in Athens 2004 and now a performance and wellness coach specialising in mental health, Leon Taylor, and a more recently retired member of England's victorious 2014 Women's Rugby World Cup squad and former Team GB hockey player Natasha Brennan. Retirement. Does it, if I say that word, does it still strike fear in your heart, Tash?
I wouldn't say fear.
Some would, which is why I asked the question.
No, I think it's been strange since I still play sport. I've gone back to playing a bit of hockey now. So, but it's funny because I think when you finish playing, for me, the way that I dealt with it was sort of compartmentalizing it slightly. So I threw myself into work. So it's only when I start to talk about it, I really think about it. So I guess, yeah, maybe a little bit. It's little drip feeds that you get when you're seeing things like you see the girls, your old teammates, they're going to the next tournament. That's when it's a kind of a little bit of a, oh, I wish I was there.
Yeah, I mean, you can feel that kind of entrenchment. Is that the one thing that your feet have come out of the quicksand of sport, and you do look enviously back at the people that are still involved, Mark?
Yeah, because that was your safe place when you think about it. You were in that environment for so long. And then to actually detach yourself from that is really difficult because that support network you had. And also, you know, you see your friends on social media and they're competing, but I always think about the times that were really hard, when I look at stuff like that, because that's the fun stuff you get to see when you're competing, you're away, you know, in tournaments and performing at the highest level. But the day in, day out grind, when you're on your knees and it's really hard, that's what I think about. And that's what I enjoy, not being in there anymore.
Obviously, yeah. Mark, yeah. From your perspective now, you're part of the EY personal performance team. So Mark's in charge of the athlete welfare and development. That gives you a good bit of breadth as well to see the good and the bad in terms of what you have to apply to yourself to get to that level, right?
Yeah, and also the spread of organisations that we're talking to across the globe. It's not just based in the UK, it's global. And that's the really interesting thing, is that all sports and an organisation, the governing bodies, are dealing with a similar type of thing. We're trying to help athletes think about what's next. Some are really good at it and some aren't so good. But it's trying to create, like, if we can create like a benchmark that will be a starting point for everyone, I think that will be a really, you know, good way to go forward. And I think with what EY are trying to do and what we've come in to do, you know, it's one of those places where we are completely independent. We're not trying to cross-sell things. We are solely there to really support and help athletes for that next step.
How were you at it, transition? How were you at it when you didn't fancy hitting the water at great speed anymore?
Yeah, so it's interesting really, because when, and I mentor lots of athletes and have done for many years now, and there's always a point where I think one of two things happened. Either your body no longer can handle what you're asking it to do, and therefore you step away, which is what happened to me, or your head no longer can handle what you're asking it to do, and therefore you step away. And so for me, it was probably easier with my body, you know, just basically saying, right, that's enough. The medical team at the High Performance Centre in Sheffield, made up of all of the doctors and physios, and they sat me down in May of 2008 in the build-up to what would have been my fourth Olympic Games. And they said, okay, Leon, so you've had four reconstructive shoulder surgeries on the same shoulder. You've just recovered from hernia surgery. You've been in chronic pain with your lower back for the past 6 years. Wow. If you were a horse, we'd have to shoot you. And now it's time to do something else, which was actually relieving in a way, because the writing was on the wall. I knew that I was in a bad place, but I wasn't willing to walk away until someone showed me the red card. And they had permission to show me the red card. And in that moment, it was a huge relief. And then at the same time, it was that emptiness, that vacuum of like, oh, it's really happened. You know, this 22-year love affair with sport is now done and I can no longer do it. And so that in itself was, it knocks you sideways. So with the being told, that's it, you no longer handle what your body can't handle it anymore. It was like, well, that's it then, it's done. And so I didn't look back with, I wish I should have carried on or anything. There was no regrets. I threw everything at my recovery from all of those surgeries and injuries, and I wasn't able to get it across the line. So I went out to Beijing as part of the BBC team to do the commentary.
Which filled a little bit of a gap for you, still involved?
Yeah, all I could think about was, I wish I was on the poolside. I reckon I could have done, you know, and I was still an athlete in the commentary box.
Do you think that was too close to the games to do that? Because what really helped me with the Olympic Games is that I retired after London, and then I got to go to Rio, commentating with the BBC, same sort of thing on My Sport. And to be completely detached from it and not be there, I think would have been really hard to deal with. But because I was there, but not actually competing, I was still living and breathing the Olympic Games. Yeah. It helped me kind of deal with that process where trying to do it a few months after you have decided, that is really tough.
Well, I mean, in some ways it was a win-win, because there was one point in the build-up to Beijing where head of major events at BBC was calling me up going, have you retired yet? We know you're injured. I'm like, sod off. I'm still good. But it was really nice because they needed to apply for a Chinese visa for me for the long list as an athlete. So at one point, looking back on it, I was going twice, once as a broadcaster, once as an athlete. Obviously, my focus was on, you know, making that fourth Olympic Games. My fairy tale ending was Leon Taylor wins gold, lives happily ever after, blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't to be. It was Leon Taylor gets to the BBC commentary team and watches this young, amazing superstar, Tom Daley, born, and he gets all the attention anyway. Brilliant. And I was well placed to be part of that transition as the sport made its way to a totally different level. But Beijing itself was incredible. I remember having a conversation with Sue Barker and I said, oh, Sue, all I want to do is compete. She put a hand on me and she said, Leon, I've been covering Wimbledon for X amount of years. Every time I watch the ladies warming up, I wish I was there. That will not change. And in some ways, she's right, because once you're an athlete and you compete at that level, anytime you go in that environment, you're like, oh.
But the connotations of your decision there, because somebody told you, in a way, they've given you a sort of get out of jail free card, haven't they? Because you don't want to let anyone down, and you use that term very loosely, because you're there to compete. You don't want to be deemed, again, we don't really use this phrase, but everyone does, in terms of being seen as a failure by stopping. If I stop now, who's going to judge me? So I suppose in one way, the positive element is that they've said, look, we've now realised at that time, but clearly those aspirations don't just die, you know? And so that's a continuum, like you've just said. And I think that's what has made us get to the level we have. I think that is the difference. You to become elite, you have to have that desire to make it that far, because there are many that, as we know, there are many that don't. But it's also a curse, because then, as I say, you carry that. You know, I, for a very long period, didn't go to matches. I never go and watch my brothers play. You know, I disassociated myself, and what Natasha said about compartmentalization, from the mental health research that Mark and I have been doing, there are huge links with PTSD. And only now, again, one of the reasons, Mark, you asked earlier why we're doing a podcast, this is why. Mm. Awareness is just as valuable to us than learning. And we're now in a place where we understand, by speaking and learning about all these different things, it gives somebody an opportunity to do better, or to be better for themselves.
But what's really interesting about what you said about they came and spoke, that's quite a mature conversation. Mm. Mm. I don't know many sports that would actually do that with their athletes that close to a games. You know, when you think about it, for them to actually sit down and talk about that, you know, normally they'll tow you along and then they'll bin you at the last minute. That's normally what happens, to keep up their numbers and blah, blah, all that sort of thing. But I think when you talk about maturity, yeah, being able to speak about things, I think that was a real good call on them to do that with you, because maybe if you had gone there and it hadn't been the fairy tale ending, what would the...
Yeah, on that question, would you have gone if they hadn't...
There's no way I could have gone. You know, it got to the point, you know.
But would you have been carried along was the question by that? Because you described the sensation as relief.
Yeah.
So somebody had to take care ultimately of stopping your sporting career.
So I guess the way it was set up, because I, you know, alongside Peter Waterfield, we won British Diving First Olympic medal in 2004 for like 44 years. And so we were, you know, at that time, you know, the most valuable asset to that sport. And obviously when you're looking at, you know, a performance at the next Olympic Games to secure funding, you know, we were, you know, if I was fit, we would have been a really good chance of getting another medal and securing funding. So everything was put behind me to get me across that line. So I was fully supported, but I literally threw everything at it, all the support I needed at, you know, as an athlete, and it just wasn't to be. So the relief was interesting, because I didn't want to acknowledge the fact that, you know, I was that broken. I was, you know, pushing. But the interesting thing, I didn't really get into the retirement space until years later, where I felt liberated. And what Mark has described is so important, because if you just look back at your highlights and you just focus on those, then, you know, there's no magic rewind button. You can't go back. But what you can do is reflect on, actually, so what couldn't I do as an athlete? Well, I could never go on holiday unless it was the, you know, time off I had in the season. I could never say yes to weddings, funerals, birthdays. So these are all the things I can do now. And I remember Mark Woods, a Paralympic swimmer, had to chat to him. And he said, you won't feel it yet, but, you know, one day you'll feel liberated. And I was like, well, really? And he was right. And it takes some time, and it's different for other people, but there's a point where you just go, oh, wow. That's pretty full on.
It's being able to take charge of your calendar, you know, of what you want to do. You know, those fun things that you watch other people do it, and, you know, people say you're an athlete, you've got this great life. Yeah, it is great. We love what we're doing. We're passionate about it. But there are so many things that you can't be part of, because you're so...
Yeah, but there must also be that part of looking occasionally. And you described enjoying Tom's success. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, Natasha, there must be those moments where you're looking at people now playing in your position, getting involved in things that you would have been involved in. Isn't there a little bit of jealousy, human nature being what it is, that, oh God, they're doing that and I'm not doing it anymore? Must be. Human nature would say it would be.
I wouldn't say jealousy.
It was a strong word.
Yeah, that's a strong word.
Envy?
No, I think there's always that element where you'll see people and you're like, oh my God, like, I mean, my thing was sevens. We were traveling the world. We were chasing the sun. You're in Dubai, you're in Australia, and you see the girls, they're on Instagram. They're in their bikinis on the beach. Don't get me wrong, on the bits that you don't see is when you're being sick on the side of the pitch because you're doing a disgusting running session, or, you know, all the other hard bits. So, you know, you do look and you see those bits and you're like, oh God, like I wish I was there. But then knowing what I know now, there is definitely a little part of me that worries for some people, knowing what some, you know, the journey that they're going through, that it will be a shock for some of them. And I feel lucky that I've worked prior to becoming a professional athlete and then coming out to going back into work, because I think there's a number of, you know, and I'm sure across all sports, but if I look at girls specifically, having an amazing opportunity to play professional sport, unbelievable, but some will be going straight from school into playing professional sport, will not have any qualifications, will never have worked. And I think that that's a scary place to be 8-10 years on, when they do realise that that part will go and they'll have to move into the real world, shall we say.
That's a big thing that happened, the dynamic shift in Olympic sport, you know, when lottery funding came in. You know, it's an amazing thing that you can train as a full-time athlete, but I remember as a youngster, I had those work-life skills because I had to go to work, I had to earn money, and then I got funding, and then I went into the system. I knew the kind of benefits of being able to train full-time, but the kind of generation of people coming through now, they've got no idea what goes on in the real world.
They've missed out on that experience, haven't they? Yeah, so I was of the age as well, as Mark said, where, you know, funding didn't come in until my career was already well underway. I'd already competed at my first Olympic Games. And so it was a real chance for me to go, oh, wow, I can really make it count now. Whereas all of the athletes now in my sport, and you know, many of the Olympic, Paralympic sports, are just like 7, 8, 9. They're surrounded by this high performance system. There's potential, there's junior development, and then you're in this system and there's no chance to kind of dip into the experience that Mark was talking about there, to get a reality check. You live in a bubble and that bubble will burst, it just depends when. And if you're not prepared in any way, and it's under preparation that athletes fall foul of, because we prepare so much for our sport, we know how important preparation is, but we do no preparation for what we do next. Then we wonder why am I feeling disillusioned, depressed, anxious, completely lost, unskilled, underprepared and struggling, which is a normal thing to feel if you haven't had chance to invest in yourself in a certain way over a period of time, just to have a little bit of an understanding of what you could do or what you might want to do or even where to start.
I think it goes back to what our agenda is, right? So something we'll touch upon a little bit later, but you look at what's our driver as Team GB, if you like, you know, the Olympic cycle. If we're looking at medals, that's fine. But now, like you said, Leon, that's starting at an earlier age. And so we're asking children, and they are that, to commit their life to sport. We're restricting their social growth. So they're not being extended and to experience the things that we do experience beyond sport. We're telling them they're the best of the best, by the way. Not just the best, they're the best of the best every day. So that's going to have a huge psychological impact on them as kids. And then if they do make it, like you said, they've been in that barrier, in that sphere for what, 20, maybe 30 years for some, maybe. And then we're not giving them the tools to become readied for the what's next. Or even during that time frame, they're perhaps missing school. They're not being around their friends. It's not a normal childhood.
Is there no control of this by the individual, though?
No, I think you need to understand where it depends on how you term it. I think if an individual were to try and do something that was out of the normal infrastructure, I think there would be consequences, because you'd be advised that there are numerous others that are trying to take your place.
But there has to be buy-in by the individual, doesn't there? It can't just be a fact that you're being pushed all the way into it. Does that indoctrinate you into a certain mindset?
I always think that this is the thing that gets cloudy, is that an athlete is driven because they want to be the best they possibly can be. And I think
all athletes, because I would say there's some saying football, for example, might be driven by the
wonder. I get there's different contexts of different sports, then, isn't there? Yeah. Olympians, you know, we talk about this, the monetary value and fame is not like it is in football. If you make it in football, it's not necessary. I remember as a kid, like being around kids, that their dream was to play at Wembley in the FA Cup final. That was all they used to talk about. I don't think you'll hear any kid talk about that now. It wouldn't be about playing in the FA Cup final.
No, and if you talk to the majority of other sports, the respect for Olympians is enormous. Because let's be honest, the financial rewards, unless there are a select few, are not there. So if you want to be the best, your commitment to that sport is alarming. And it does alarm me. What these guys will have had to put themselves through to get to that level and to sustain that level of performance is unbelievable to me. And we have big, hefty rugby players that, you know, run non-stop for 80 plus minutes a week. A lot of the footballers, they look at what these guys do, and there is huge adulation for what they've achieved, knowing what they have to go through, the restrictions they have to work under, the conditions you perhaps have to train under. For me, that's a different level. It's a different level to commitment, because they're doing it because they really want to achieve for themselves and for the sport.
There's so many, you're going to say something else. I'm still trying to deal with something I wanted to ask 15 minutes ago. You said they were cloudy waters. So Scott was talking about from an early age being pushed by the stakeholders, by the organisations. I said, wait a minute, isn't there some choice in here? And you were about to tell us something before we went sidewinding off.
It's when you go into that high performance environment and there's coaches, sometimes they forget the reason you're there is because you want to be the best you can be. It's not you're there to please them and, you know, you're going to toe the line and obviously the program or anything, but you are there because you want to be there. And I think, I remember as a youngster in my sport, they seemed to forget that. It was more of a dictatorship rather than I'm here because I want to be the best I can be. And, you know, you're kind of pushed into this system where, you know, the survival of the fittest, basically. If you can complete everything and do well in all the assessments, you'll kind of make it. And I always used to really kind of get frustrated because I wasn't there to please them. I was there on a daily basis to get better. So it was nice to be in that environment, but I could have trained on my own and worked probably just as hard, but not had the people around me, but it was the infrastructure of being in that environment.
This is interesting because I was doing an event with Casey Stoney, the Manchester United ladies manager, maybe 6-9 months ago, and I talked to her about sacrifice. She said, no. I never saw any of my sporting career as sacrifice, any of the preparation. I saw it as a choice. And that seems to me to be fully taking ownership and taking some of the pressure off yourself to have to go through tasks that...
Well, I think you have your own pressure. Like, you have your own expectation. If you're going to work 7 days a week or, you know, 4 to 6 hours a day of exercise and training, now you have your own internal pressure on yourself and expectation of what
you're doing.
I get
that, but these were choices that you made. Or did you see it as sacrifice? Did you see it as sacrifice what you did at times?
I think it's absolutely a choice. It's definitely a choice. But when you're being given, you know, £1,100 to live off a month as a professional full-time player, I mean, it's like get your accommodation, get your food and, you know, whatever. It's difficult to say that that's not a sacrifice because there are things that you're having to trade off. So I think there are elements, but obviously it's a choice because that's what you have to do to get to the next step. But
yeah, it's a nice reframe, isn't it? It's a sacrifice or choice. You've ultimately you put yourself at cause or effect, don't you? Put yourself at cause. These are the choices I'm making. I'm choosing,
including sacrificing your body in your case with
yes, I suppose you can look back at it, but I wasn't trying to get injured, and it was, you know, when you push the limits, they push back. No, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because it's like, well, if you'd have known that now, would you have gone through it? My answer is yeah, because it was that pursuit of something far greater than I could imagine, you know, the dream of watching Olympic Games on the TV when I was six and not really knowing what they were and being totally mesmerized. And then all of my choices after that were based on this, on a foundation of hyperactivity, which was great because my parents would channel me off into these sports and eventually I'd get tired. And it was this most amazing, amazing choices that I made along the way. But of course it comes at a cost, right? So if you're choosing one thing over another, then arguably you're sacrificing your experience of that. But I think that, you know, the environment gives you a chance to thrive. Now, if the environment is you come into this high performance sporting environment and all you do is sport, and then you're looking at everyone else and that's all they're doing, then of course, what are you going to do? You're just going to fall into that. You don't realize there's another way.
Yeah.
The Australians did it really, really well in my generation, where I used to chat to the Australian divers. They'd be like, oh yeah, we have to do 15 hours of either study, voluntary work or paid work every week that we're not away competing. And that's mandatory. And I was like, oh, that's pretty harsh. I just get to train all the time. But actually, they thrived, and they, at that time in my generation, they came away with more Olympic medals than everyone but China in my sport. And I was like, wow, there is another way. Imagine if I was in that environment where I had to make a choice to do something else other than sport, rather than kind of battle against it a bit. Should I do this? Should I do that? And I thought, well, then they come out the other side, arguably more balanced in, don't really like that word, but they've come out with more resources, right, that they can implement now in life after sport. So some of them are in professions that they managed to figure out along the way doing voluntary work, or whether it was paid work, or whether it was studying. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? If you give those athletes a chance to thrive in that way and educate themselves, when they come out the other side, they're not as they're not falling into that abyss that we talk about.
But that's fascinating as well, because you wonder whether without the success that the Australians received rightfully during that time, whether there would have been what that balanced view. We've more recently had success, right? So our medals have increased. Do you feel that that is now why the conversations around a more broader approach towards athlete care is being discussed? Or do you think it's causal from what we have been reading about in terms of injuries and the ramifications of committing yourself to a specific sport? Do you think it comes one with the other, or do you think that gives us the opportunity and the space to critique how we've done things historically?
Yeah, I think you've always got to improve, haven't you? So our high performance system now is amazing, because my first Olympic Games in 96, we quote this all the time, don't we? So Team GB 36 on the medal table. The next year was the advent of the lottery funding, and then it's been that steady climb to, you know, one of the top Olympic and Paralympic superpowers, I believe, that we referred to. And that comes at a cost, you know, and the cost has been, you know, the duty of care that we're discussing now. So it's like, well, how do you know what's going to happen? There's no crystal ball. Now that we know what's happened, what can we do about it? And we need to do something about it. We need to do more. And it's what's the best tack, what's the best approach. And I believe that, preparation, education and knowledge. And the earlier that you can get that into an environment where these young athletes in whatever sport are, then whenever their career comes to an end through injury, illness, underperformance, or they just don't want to do it anymore, or the other reasons that they could do, at least then they go, okay, well, at least I'm a little bit prepared rather than not prepared at all.
And I think it's trying to make it normal. So it's not this big change. We're going to add, you know, work experience or studying or whatever it is. When you come into that environment and you sign that high performance contract with your sport, mm-hmm. but you're going to be given this funding, you know, you're going to have this infrastructure, this support stuff around you. But with that comes this side, and this goes hand in hand with that. You don't just have one or the other. And if one's falling behind, then we have to obviously make adjustments to make sure that that stays on track. And I think if you embedded that at the start, that would change this massively. At the moment, we're trying to work out how do we create a cure. Well, let's try and prevent it, as you were saying. Go back to the start. When you become an elite athlete, these two things go hand in hand. So whenever your extraction from the sport, whether it be, you know, you decide to make that retirement or injury, or you get deselected, you lose your funding, you are ready to step out and kind of be in a better position and move on with life, rather than looking back going, I've just wasted 8 years of my life because now I'm starting from literally nothing.
Well, this is topical because Dame Catherine Granger has now suggested, put to the government, that we lift the funding from 500 million to $1 billion per Olympic cycle. If we do that over the next three Olympics, we can top the medal table by 2032. She's obviously the chairperson of Sport England, for anybody that doesn't know. But this is going to bring a whole different raft of general public expectations and a whole different raft, I would assume, of fallout from those that don't make it, Scott.
Yeah, you would say that it would be common sense that if we're looking to increase the number of medals in the table, that the contribution numbers are going to be even higher. So if we're going to look to increase our performance per Olympic cycle, there's going to need to be more athletes that are committing to that cycle, which means the fallout rate is going to increase dramatically. Going back to Leon's point and what Mark has just quite rightly said, is there a stance we take where if we are requesting an increased level of funding, that we're broadening the facilities we're offering these athletes? Because it does, you know, one comes with the other. If we're asking them, our performances to increase, and we're asking for more from these athletes, and we're asking for more athletes to contribute to this success, then do we need to fulfill our responsibilities from within sport to ensure that if they are committing this time and they don't quite make it to the Olympics, for example, that they do have an opportunity, they have a conscious choice?
Yeah, well, you're almost asking it as a question. You know what the answer is.
That again, it'd be interesting
to know what the breakdown of that extra funding is. Is it just to have a bigger pool at the bottom that's going to filter through to the top? because if you've already got 12,
don't look at me like that, Natasha, like I've got the answers to this. I'm just giving you the top
but
line.
If you've got 1,200 athletes already being funded, and only, you know, the Olympic Games, we send between 300 and 400 roughly, that's, you know, 800-900 that aren't actually going, isn't it? So, you know, if we increase that pool of athletes, is that even more people that are going to be disappointed, left out, and then trying to work out what they do next? Where if there is an infrastructure that no matter where you fit in that, we are going to make sure that we're taking care of you. And if that extra money is partly for that, then that's a big step forward. But when you come back and talk about the top in the medal table, I don't really think that's a big deal personally. You know, we take pride in that as athletes, but if you ask the general public, you know, where did we finish in the last two Olympics, they probably wouldn't have a clue. What people do attach to is individuals or team performances that they remember and they would talk about. So it comes to that, you know, how do we advance that branding of that sport, that individual, to really maximize return that people get from that kind of that medal or that display of performance and really attach themselves to it. I really don't think top of the medal table is...
Well, she's your friend. No, but
we're able to talk about that, you know, and as athletes, you know, we've all got our own opinions on different things.
But Mark, on that, so Leon, you obviously mentor Tom. How he's clearly approached, I would say, his career very differently. Clearly, he's been quite public from a very young age. And I don't know him personally, so I don't know if that was invited. But you would say if the general public were to mention, you could more or less guarantee that Tom would be in the top 10 in terms of who they know. And yet he hasn't had that success that he perhaps may have hoped for, or that people, the expectation that people would have given him, because I do think that it had been given to him. You know, what would your observations around that be?
Tom is an anomaly, isn't he? So you can't really kind of look at his uniqueness and the way that he, you know, at a very young age, you know, very precocious talent, incredible athlete, and, you know, still has unfinished business. He's all eyes on Tokyo next year because, yeah, rightly, if you ask him what his sporting goals are, you know, ever since, you know, he's dreamed, you know, as a young boy to stand on the top of that Olympic podium, and that hasn't been, you know, his fairy tale ending yet. Will he get there? Well, he's putting everything into it.
Is he putting everything into it? Because I would say he's incredibly marketable. Mm. He's gone off and done the Splash series, which I know you were involved with at one point, weren't you? So by being a bit more rounded, has it been to the detriment of his sport?
Yeah,
has he gone outside his sector too much?
No, I think that's a really good point, Mark. And I think it's one I wanted to make earlier, is that me personally, when I had something else to concentrate on other than my sport, my sporting performance was much better. When all I was focusing on was my sporting performance, all my eggs were in one basket, and a bad day was a bad life. And that wasn't the case. So when I was studying alongside training full time, when I was injured, which I was many times during the end of my career, I was like, oh, great. And then I'd head off to the library, I'd be at university studying part time, which I did off my own back. I kind of went, OK, I've got to do this. You know, I've got to find a way to rebalance my scorecard. And Tom, you know, with his interest in a multitude of areas, gives himself the chance to find that balance that he needs. So you're right, he has time where he's focusing on developing X, Y, and Z, the different products he's in. And again, it means that he can deal with the pressures of performing and the public pressures on someone like Tom. As you think, people, you ask some people to say, oh, what about Tom? Like, oh, yeah, he's won Olympic gold, hasn't he?
That's right.
Oh, no, he hasn't. No, he got a... And then you go, and he goes, well, no, he didn't actually, because he had this. And then in Rio, this happened, and, you know, two bronzes, and he's, you know, world champion a few times over. But it's interesting, isn't it, really, the public perception and what the reality is. But my thing is that you've got to think not just the elites like Tom, you know, the household names, and then you've got the 1,200 on funding. But then what about all the others who are trying to get on funding? What message are we giving to them? Is that if you get onto funding, you train full time, and that's all you have to do, and then after the end of it, you're screwed. No, we want to go, when you're on funding, there's a provision where there's a duty of care. We're looking out for you. We're giving the opportunity to educate yourself in this way so that when you step away, that you're going to be able to go somewhere and you're not going to fall into mental health problems, or you're less likely to fall into some of these challenges that we know are coming. And then therefore, if you're trying to get onto that, you think, well, if I get there and I have to do that when I get there, why don't I do it now? what's the thing I can do here? So I've got a bit of funding, I'm working part-time, I'm going to invest in myself or whatever it is. And then this culture changes of what we're actually trying to do here, that athletes don't have all their eggs in one basket and they're not just hoping on this wish to get through, that they're well-rounded.
Which is exactly the whole basis of your personal performance.
No, it's absolutely spot on. You know, we know that this has to be a cultural change. There's no quick fix to this. You know, sport has been the way it is for a very, very long time, and aspirations or viewed aspirations have been plateaued for a long period. I think, you know, this topic is really timely, because do we need to, for example, reevaluate what success is? You know, is success, yes, us topping the medal charts? Or is it having...
Well, Catherine Granger says it is.
Mark, no, but this is why we're here.
I do understand why you would put that as a goal for everyone. But I don't think, you know, when you talk about, you know, you just mentioned about Tom, you know, if we can increase the brand awareness of individuals and teams and sports, that's what people really associate with. I've kind of asked people in the general public, like when I talk to them in the bar or restaurants, you know, where did we come in Rio? In the medal table, and not one of them knew where it was, and they were sports fanatics as well. But if you ask them to, can you remember a particular medal that stands out, or an individual, they'll give you one straight away.
But also the reality is, the number of individuals that are committing to an Olympic cycle, you know, if we got this right, we could create such a hotbed type of ecosystem where if you don't quite make it to the Olympics, you're there to help those that are perhaps on the next cycle. Or if you do, you can then pass down that experience to somebody else. The reality is, at the moment, and I'd say this is a blanket comment about the majority of sports, we don't exercise the talent and the experience that these individuals are going through. And doesn't always have to be experience at Olympic Games. It can just be the process. By being able to pass that on to those that are looking up that hill thinking, I have to climb it, that's fantastic. You can't, as they say in sport, you can't buy experience. And that phrase keeps being used. So why don't we replenish that experience in a way that's positive? I mean, Natasha, for you, for example, did you see a difference in culture from hockey to rugby? And how did you find that change? Or was it a coping mechanism? Or was it just that you love sport and you wanted to sustain your position within that elite environment?
I think there are differences in culture. I suppose it was quite interesting because hockey in some respects was more developed than rugby and vice versa. But obviously hockey centralised programme started sort of leading into Beijing, and the women's rugby only really became professional in 2014. So the way that they were managed were very different, which is interesting to see from both sides. And I suppose rugby's going through that phase at the moment, which hockey was gone through six years ago, whereby people coming straight into the system now and they can get a professional contract, whereby it's obviously managed differently, which I suppose is interesting because specifically rugby is an Olympic sport, it's all funded through the RFU. And obviously with a number of the Olympic sports, that's obviously funded through Sport England, yeah, which creates different challenges as to how money's distributed and how people are treated, obviously, because there's different ways it's managed.
Now, at this point, we're going to level with you. We'd reached our allotted time for this podcast, and Scott and I still had a lot more to discuss with our guests, Mark Hunter, Leon Taylor and Natasha Brennan. So I tell you what, rather than cut them short, we're going to make this a two-parter. So for the time being, I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World. Thanks for listening to the latest part episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Look out for part two. Goodbye.